Welcome to another edition of the 5Cs podcast. I'm your host, Charlene Norman, and this is where we discuss all things clarity and collaboration for the community of climate change makers. This is the second episode in our series that I am calling Degrowth Part 2. You specifically asked for more information and details about this topic, and I found a most interesting guest. Richard Muscat calls himself a degrowth student. His entire professional career has been a passion for innovation. Whether he worked with world-class organizations building and managing high-performing teams and products, whether he pivoted into clean tech and startups, including his own, or whether he's guiding companies interested in creating value in the regenerative space, it's always been about innovation and practical sense. And all of Richard's links are in the show notes. In the first episode, I asked Richard what he saw in the world with the integration of the new concept known as degrowth into business. Today, let's jump to the point where I ask him to explain the best ways to share the benefits of degrowth and attract companies to the concept.
Depending on which companies we're talking about, it's different approaches, right? So I would say, you know, as a proponent of degrowth, and I would say, you know, the degrowth is meant to be a transition period to a point where then you are operating in what is called a steady state or stable economy that is not purely focused on growth, right? The term that tends to get used that I find easiest to work with is that it's a transition period. It's a little bit like if you're a smoker, like I was, you know, there's a point where you decide you're going to stop, or, you know, maybe you stop drinking and so on. And there's that period where you have withdrawal symptoms and it's hard and so on. But that's not forever. That's a small period of time. That's a transition period, right? And that's maybe a hard thing to be able to go through, depending on what the issue is. But, you know, it's a transition period. It's degrowing harmful activities, means reducing harmful activities so that, and this is essential, so that you can focus on other, more regenerative activities, which are still there to provide human flourishing, education, well-being, and so on. So there's a lot of backstory to a lot of this stuff relating to how capitalism came about and the effects of colonialism and all of this kind of stuff. Right? But if you just look at nowadays, for example, what degrowth proponents would imagine degrowth policies to be, you know, where did if you had a government, for example, that was aligned with that principle, you're looking at things like universal access to healthcare, universal access to education, free, of course, is what we're talking about here. A universal basic income, debt cancellation. So we're talking about things which are reducing the financial and stressful burden on people that has been placed there very often purely because the society is argued around, as society is organized around the requirement to grow financially, right? So then when you look at what does a company do, there are a lot of things that a company can do. And there are some really interesting examples, and I'll use some small and big ones, right? So there is a very famous big example is Patagonia, the outdoor clothing company. That is a perfect example of a company that is setting limits on its own growth. And it is a remarkable example because it is a very large and very profitable organization, you know, along the lines of Coke, Amazon, Nike, and all these kinds of large organizations, which is very unusual. Similar to Patagonia, and the only other example I can think of companies which are quite large, is Lush, who have taken a lot of steps and put a lot of effort into trying to decouple themselves from this sort of a growth mindset and growth economy. You know, Lush is a cosmetics product, right? They have really worked on trying to make sure that everything is sustainable, reusable, fair, and so on. They have completely disengaged from marketing tactics like using social media, for example. So you will not find Lush on YouTube and Twitter and so on, at least not in an active way. You know, a lot of social media and advertising is really about creating and inflating demand for the purposes of creating financial growth. What I meant before about when I said about unnecessary waste, for example, and so on. And you see this a lot in the large supermarkets or large retailers and so on, where you are invited to purchase more than you need. And it's made to look attractive and it's made to look like the sensible choice. And so you end up in a situation where you then discard and throw away a lot of the stuff that you purchased. There was a recent study that a friend of mine shared because he's interested in this, in food waste in particular, where, for example, it's estimated that Los Angeles as a city wastes 40% of its food. It's literally like going shopping, having two shopping baskets and throwing one away. Every shop, you're throwing 40% of your food away. And that is a lifestyle that is engineered or at least exploited by a lot of these organizations. Other organizations at a different scale, for example, are I have a person I know, for example, runs a marketing agency, and they have consciously decided to stay small, in a sense of, for example, they have implemented a 4-day week. They have been replacing clients rather than growing their client portfolio, where they are doing their best to replace clients with clients that are aligned with their values. In their case, it is about sustainability and health. And so rather than focusing purely on how many more clients can we get and how much more growth can we engineer for all of our clients, they're looking at making a small group of people that they have a good relationship with are successful, and make sure that they have a long-term relationship with these clients so that they're not worried about going out of business. There are other examples in between, like, for example, most cooperatives are a great example of what is a post-growth organization. There is plenty of evidence that they work as well as other organizations in terms of generating employment, creating good salaries, and so on. There are organizations called B Corps or profit for good organizations, as well as steward-owned companies, right? So steward-owned companies, like, for example, in the UK, there is River Cottage, is an organic farming organization. I hope I'm getting it right that they're steward-owned. Maybe they're employee-owned or community-owned. But the point is moving towards a more democratic style of ownership, which represents a diversity of opinions and backgrounds, including representing, you know, they talk about having nature on the board, for example, rather than just having 4 or 5 individuals who are calling all the shots. And it's uncomfortable, of course. It is very uncomfortable to maybe move from having an organization where there's 2 or 3 people running it to opening up and changing how that works. So I understand that a lot of people might be disinclined to even consider it, perhaps, at first. But those are some examples of the kinds of organizations that we talk about. It doesn't have to be just charities and nonprofits.
Change is hard, particularly when you're going down a road that you've never, ever, ever been through before, because it is so new. What are the main characteristics that you see smart business leaders have or are quick to pick up on in order to go down this path? What sets them apart?
The thing I can probably point to the most is, I don't know what the right term for it is. I was going to say empathy, but it's not just empathy by itself. Empathy, sure, but I mean empathy for, like, having witnessed and having a lived experience of the effect of regular capitalism, right? So I say regular capitalism, just capitalism, really. If there's a place that you love, maybe it's a forest or a river or something that you grew up in, and you go and visit that place again, and it's dead. That's the thing I mean. Like a really personal connection where you feel like, oh, I see. This is what's happening. We're destroying the things that are valuable. And for some people, that is having seen animal cruelty take place in industrial farms, or it's seen places being devastated by pollution, or it's because you've been to certain countries in this the global south where folks are treated badly or enslaved and so on by the processes that these companies are maintaining. And the people I've spoken to or that I personally know that have felt like that they need to make a change are people who've come face to face with this in daily life in some way. It's an acknowledgement that, yes, what I am doing is causing harm and I need to stop doing it.
It's not something then that you can just go off to a seminar and, oh, yeah, you're going to get the fever. It's not something you're going to learn in school and, oh, yeah, that's the way it is. You've got to have felt the impact somewhere in your own life and the negative impacts.
Yeah. Maybe to illustrate rather, the point is you see, you know, the value within quotes, right? But this is why supply chains have become so complex and so lengthy. Because I think that if the people running certain organizations in Europe and in America were on the ground in Malaysia or in the Democratic Republic of the Congo or in Colombia, seeing what the far end of their supply chain looks like, it's intolerable. But because it's so distant, it's fine. And by the people at the top, I mean even the people who are possibly doing their best, you know, regular employees, managers, sustainability professionals trying to do their due diligence on the supply chains and so on. It is too far removed for it to be effective. And I remember having this thought a few months ago in May, I believe, when I attended a conference in Vienna. And there was a Colombian activist who was in Europe representing people from mining towns in Colombia who did not want to be mining towns. And their slogan, you know, their call to action was, "We want the right to say no." And the point being that they don't have the right to say no. And to be able to get that message across, they have to come to Europe because nobody from Europe ever goes there, right? And I'm using Europe here. I'm using Europe as an example of who's at the top of the food chain. It could equally have been Washington or Canada or Canberra in Australia, right? It's they happen to be in Europe because there was a piece of legislation the European Union was you know, having going through its processes about disclosures in the supply chains. And I mean, you literally have an entire European Parliament of hundreds of elected representatives legislating on supply chain due diligence and disclosures to avoid child slavery and pollution and etc. They are doing this literally in Brussels, in their fancy offices, without going to see what's happening. And so it can't work. I don't believe it can work like that. It's too far. But then when you see somebody in that position actually go there, which doesn't happen very often, then you suddenly see people who are like, oh, wow, this is what's happening. And then they become activists. And so having that personal experience, I think, is crucial. I mentioned Lush before, the founders of Lush were all activists. The founders of Patagonia are all, you know, outdoor enthusiast people who maybe they don't have sustainability at heart in the sense of in the way the Lush people do, but they have a love of the activity and they don't want the activity to disappear, right? But when there is only the love of the game of growth, then it's very hard for something else to have an impact. You need to see and touch the effect of your actions, which is very hard.
We live with the unintended consequences of our collective actions over the last 100 years or so. All of us can see with our own eyes that so many of those unintended consequences are devastating. And we all, if we could, would do a do-over. But a do-over? Not possible. The best thing we can do with our accumulated lived experience is a do-better. And that do-better must be in the highest good for all.